Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Becky Johnson, an actor and improviser who's appeared on stage in Sheila Hetty's All Our Happy Days Are Stupid and Danny McIver's A Beautiful View, among many other things. You can see her online in the web series Space Writers Division Earth, and you can find her through the end of this year at Toronto's Second City, where she's performing in the main stage review Come What Mayhem. And you should do that. I've seen it. It's a really good show. Becky chose Badlands, Terrence Malick's remarkable debut feature that reinterprets the Charles Starkweather spree killings through a stylized fictional lens, with Martin Sheen's enigmatic rebel Kit seducing Sissy Spacek's Dreamy Holly into a life on the run, if that's really what happens. Malick's not interested in recounting the facts of the story as they happened, but in exploring the whys of it, watching his characters forge a connection against the emptiness of the South Dakota landscapes. It's also the film that lays out the themes that will dominate Malick's work in the decades to come. The search for comfort in the inexplicable movement of life, the need to divine something greater amidst the chaos, and also wheat. This is someone else's movie.
Well, I had a really hard time deciding on a movie. Not a really hard time, but a bit of a hard time.
It happens.
I think it was like the thought about like a movie that really stuck to my bones and that has stuck with me since the first time I saw it in a way that was unusual and singular. Mm-hmm. You know, not just you did this thing well that a lot of people do well, but like you've done something well that I've never seen before or since, exactly as it is. And I guess that's the work of the auteur, right?
Yeah.
Terrence Malick. But I think that was it. And the other thing for me personally is that I think when I think about stories or films that I personally really gravitate towards, they're basically all about America.
Okay.
And I mean North America. And there's like a time period or a feeling of like the openness of the West that is like almost everything I've ever liked in film and literature and television, I've realized. Like okay. If the list is like, Badlands, Days of Heaven, Twin Peaks, Linda Barry's book, Cruddy, Flannery O'Connor. It's like, these are all, I mean, that's the South, but still there's this like unsettled openness.
Right.
Anyway, so that was the thing I realized where I was like, that's probably going to be part of what the movie I choose.
It's really interesting. I mean, the idea of mythical potential, I think, kind of runs through all of that.
Yeah. And it's also like, you know, romanticizing the West or open spaces is also not healthy or good, but it's yeah. something I do.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, God, it's part of the Canadian myth.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I'm from the West Coast too. I don't know if that has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. Just feeling like I'm from the edge of the world.
Right.
At a certain time.
It's a frontier thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. And there's a lot of frontierness in this, right?
Yeah. It's funny. Whenever people bring up Badlands, it's always in a context that I never see coming. And it's always comics. It's always people who work in comedy.
It's got very funny moments in it, too.
It is.
But they're super weird.
Yeah, nobody remembers it that way. Everybody remembers the sort of the weird sense of peace that settles over the film and that tension that's like underneath everything, the thing that Malick does so well.
Yeah.
But like Richard Ayoade said that it was a huge influence on his film Submarine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love that movie, too.
But yeah, but
that's
does it...
That's fascinating.
Does that connect to you? Because it didn't to me. I sort
In a
of
weird
understand
way.
It, but...
Well, one of the things I would say that's interesting is, like... So I rewatched it last night.
Oh, wow.
And I read some things. I don't know if I was supposed to or not. Like,
you can
I read
do whatever
some,
you want.
I can do whatever. I read some reviews. And, like, consistently they called Sissy Spacek's character dumb or simple. Roger Ebert called her simple. And
yeah.
I was like, whoa, I don't feel that way about her at all. Which isn't to say that I know that I'm right. It's just that if I saw it a completely different way, that means that you're not right either. This is much more up to interpretation than you've allowed it to be when
sure,
you just
yeah.
call her that. Because I was like, for me watching this as a woman and thinking about what it was like to be a young woman, which it seems to have a lot, that seems to have a lot to do with it. The sort of like trying on personalities, that saying less and doing less also reveals less of yourself, which is an important thing to do when you're figuring yourself out.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It does. It absolutely does.
So anyway, but as far as like interpretations of this, when I read those things where like they call her like stupid or simple or whatever, I was like, that's not how I see it at all, which means, yeah, there's something very interesting going on here, because their interpretations can be absolutely right for them and mine can be right as well, which is one of the things that's amazing about this film.
Yeah. I do think you're right in this case.
Yes.
Well, she's not. Yeah. I mean, she's an innocent maybe, but she's not dumb. I think she's definitely presented as more watchful than anybody else in the film. She's the one telling the story.
She also may or may not be innocent. Like, that's how I feel about the whole movie, is it makes you question what you can possibly know about another person. Mm-hmm. And like what she says in dialogue, what she says in narration, I don't know, how can you possibly know what amount of that's true or real? And it's so like romantic and kind of pulp novel-y, especially the narration. It's it clearly is in some ways a regurgitation of stuff she's read. And he finds this book, right, in her suitcase. So presumably, to me, she was writing it all down in that book.
Right.
Right? And that's why he kept it. So if she's writing it down, she's made the choice to mythologize. Right. And this is how she wants to do it. We can't assume that this is exactly what she feels the most. Yeah. It's what she wants to say, which is different than what you feel.
I have wondered once or twice watching the film whether it's the statement she's giving to the police, like down the line, or a prepared version of it, if this is her frame for it.
Right.
Even if she'll never deliver it, maybe this is what we're hearing in her head.
Yeah.
But
the
unreliable narrator aspect is definitely part of the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's packaged that way. Mm-hmm. And it is, like, I always forget how soon it is after, or how that was... not the right grammatical expression. Mm-hmm. I always forget how quickly it followed Bonnie and Clyde. Like, it really does feel thematically, theatrically, like an answer movie.
It was
maybe
Bonnie,
5 years
and after... And that's, Faye Dunaway.
And Warren Beatty, yeah, in 67.
That was in 67, and this was 73?
Yeah. But Bonnie and Clyde kind of cycled for a little while. It didn't really hit until 68, because it was re-released after a positive reviews and almost withdrawn. It was a whole thing. And if the way Malick works is so slow and contemplative, then I could kind of see it filtering through his head and thinking, and him just responding to that movie with, well, it's not cool exactly, and it's not adorable to kill people.
It's not cool, but it's not not cool.
Yeah.
Like, it's not cool, but I can see, or like, you can see why they find it that way. Like, they're the ones... In this film, the perpetrators are the ones who are experiencing the joy, not the people following them. Right. Unlike Natural Born Killers, where it's so overt, like...
Yeah, that's encouraging the audience to join in.
Yeah, and that's the point. But this is like, it's like kind of, in a lot of ways, it's mentioned that people are paying attention to them, but you really don't see it.
Yeah.
Don't see
no
it very
circus,
much at all.
There's no...
Yeah, there's a circus only at the end. And not really, even.
Yeah. It's much more concerned with the bond between the two leads rather than it is between the bond with the leads and the audience, or the leads and the world around them.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it lingers, because there are so many movies. And the other thing it's an answer to in a weird way is the thrill kill movies from the 50s and 60s, those pulp programmers of, you know, teenage delinquents on the run, on the rampage. This is really, everything has consequences, everything has weight. And you're sort of made to feel what's happening, even if the characters aren't quite aware of it. And maybe that's why they write her off as dumb, because she just doesn't fully...
It's because she doesn't react.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean
engage with what's happening.
Just because people don't see it doesn't mean you aren't feeling something. And that's one of the things that I find so amazing about this film. Oh, you want to know another fun fact?
Sure.
When it was released, I think... it was released as a double bill with Blazing Saddles.
I have heard this. I think it probably ended up that way.
Like an original release?
Second run, maybe?
No, I think it was the original one, and then it had to kind of be... I could be wrong. I mean, I'm not a fact checker anymore. But, which I find unbelievably bizarre.
Yeah.
As an idea of what... Like, why? It's like they're both on the planes?
They were released by the same studio? They both start with B? I mean, it's true that there were drive-in pairings, things like that happened all the time, because a distributor would send films along into second run, but I can't imagine either of those movies being initially released as a double bill.
I think that's what I read, but I could be wrong, or I could have read something wrong.
You're probably right.
Then it had to be re-released on its own, because it premiered at you know, New York Film Festival. So it had all these things, but then when it was picked up in the sort of packaging, it was put out this way, I think, which seems utterly bizarre.
Yeah, my brain is actively rejecting the possibility, but it doesn't mean I'm right.
There are two movies I like that I would never want to see as a double bill.
Yeah. It just, I mean, those are such different audiences, too. I mean, which one would play first? How do you get the room back, like, after you?
Yeah, after either, I know. Anyway, so I guess that was my answer to the first question.
When was your first exposure? When did you first see it?
I don't know. I'm pretty bad with, like, details like this in general, but...
Younger, older?
Well, I would have been in my 20s.
Okay.
I guess. I wasn't a kid. Yeah, I guess in my 20s. And I haven't seen it that many times. It's not like I watch it constantly. But I also didn't feel like I had to.
Yeah.
There's so much that stuck with me. For myself, with movie viewing, I'm extremely bad at hanging on to details. I'll forget dialogue. I can't even remember the dialogue I wanted to remember from last night. The things that really stood out that I wanted to bring up are visual details, but the sort of general feeling is something that usually sticks with me, which makes rewatching movies really fun because I forget so much. They're like kind of, you know, I'll be like, oh yeah, this thing's about to happen, but I won't know right until before. Maybe it's like that for a lot of people.
Right.
But this movie, every time I watch it, there's different little visual things I pick up on. And it's like in a Kubrick sense of like, did he plan all of this? Did his subconscious do it?
Yeah.
Because there's so many things. Every single action and image seems like a metaphor for something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel wasted.
No, Malick definitely, like, he has the quality, he has the ability to load everything and nothing into a scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can watch Tree of Life and come away as the audience I saw it with was just frustrated and bored and restless. I thought it was the best film I'd seen that year, and I ended and I was in a state of rapture. Just like, I really want to call my dad and I really want to just sit here for about an hour, and then I had to get pushed down the stairs and interview Jessica Chastain on stage in front of the remaining portion of the audience.
Wow.
Because the guy who was supposed to do it didn't show up, and that's a whole story. But there were people who like actively hated the things that I loved in that film. And that's a movie that's kind of non-narrative and doesn't really have a structure the way Badlands does. Badlands is probably, I mean, I'm trying to think of another film he's made that's more conventional. It's easily the most conventional movie. Maybe Days of Heaven. Maybe The Thin Red Line, because it's a war film.
I think, well, the other thing, though, is that sort of both Days of Heaven and Badlands have... Badlands more so have an element of road movie, which is a great structure for someone who doesn't like narrative, because you don't have to hang on to anything except for the, you know, you don't have to hang on to anything but the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we accept it completely because that's how road movies are. That's how travel is. Right.
Yeah.
So, and Days of Heaven has travel too. Right. So the core people are the core people, and you just toss away every storyline because they're back, like further back on the road.
Yeah. You're whatever adventure they're having, you're with them. That's
yeah. And it makes sense that they've walked away from every other interaction they've had, because that's how travel is.
Yeah.
So in a way, it is narrative, but it's found a very good narrative for somebody, or narrative structure for somebody who doesn't really seem to like narrative very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like narrative very much, to be quite honest. So maybe that's part of it.
It has its uses. I mean, I think...
It does.
Certainly this film, just because it's a... criminal on the run, like you can describe it that way, you can describe it as a romance, you can describe it as a road movie, but all of those things, there's an end in sight. It's as opposed to some of the other films where it just sort of dissolves into rapture or fades away, or something like Knight of Cups, where okay, it ends, but I don't even know it really started. It was just
I haven't seen that either. I actually haven't seen very many of his movies.
It's a very experiential film.
Yes, yeah,
sadly, don't mean that in a positive
way. No.
For Knight of Cups, a lot of Tree of Life is phenomenal.
Is Knight of Cups the one with Christian Bale?
Yeah,
I didn't want to see him in a Terrence Malick movie.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I just really didn't, and that's not fair of me, but I didn't.
No, you're probably right to want the things you want for him for that. I mean, even I'm in that weird position where, having just watched this thing he's been working on for 40 years, The Voyage of Time, I think he found a way to say everything he wanted to say in Tree of Life. I think all the other movies, Badlands included, are working towards that, are getting him to that point where he can make this story about himself, which it absolutely is. Tree of Life is like his childhood, his impressions. These are things.
It's hilarious because everything else has been so private.
Exactly.
And maybe he's hoarding it so that he can do it the way he wants.
Yeah.
To.
And now that he's done it, I think he's just sort of, he wants to keep working and he likes it, but yeah, I don't know that he has anything left to say.
Cool.
Yeah. I kind of hope he finds another way to not say something. But the sort of ineffable quality that's in Badlands, and God, I said ineffable. I'm terrible. I'm a film critic. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I just hate those terms being thrown. Well, you know, the thing you can't describe, it's just the thing you can't describe. I can describe what Malick does, which is this gorgeous, rapturous, emotional state that's probably more valid than the narrative he's telling. Like, he puts you into his... Malick's strength as a filmmaker, his greatest gift is the ability to make you identify with someone who you don't necessarily want to be, but to do it through the texture of the film rather than through any kind of, hey, these people, they're just like us. You're just in that situation. You're plugged in.
And I think, yeah, watching this movie right now, given, I think, a lot of the stuff that I have been seeing recently, and also working as an actor, so I go out for, I get scripts to have all these weird things I go out for all the time.
Yeah.
Just like a movie that doesn't tell you what to think or feel is such a relief.
Yeah.
Something that doesn't make a point of telling you what the point is. It's just like, I don't know, there's something I find so respectful to the audience in that. And also this experience of some people hate it and some people love it, that's also extremely important.
Yeah.
To me as an actor, because for the work I do, sometimes I'm like, you know, people really don't seem to like this, but I know this is exactly the thing that I want to be doing right now. And then watching a movie like this and going, to me, this is, I'm so glad this exists for me selfishly. And I don't care if a lot of people don't agree with me. I'm so glad Terrence Malick made this so that I could see it. And so to be on the receiving end of something for me gives me more confidence to do stuff when people are telling me it's wrong.
Yeah.
If I know that it's not to me. And it's like, if only 10% of the people like it, that 10% will be, how did this get made? I've never seen anything like this. This is what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And again, that's maybe hoping for quite a bit for myself, but that's what we have to do. It's people who create stuff, right?
Yeah.
But that's how, like, the fact that this movie wasn't particularly well received is baffling to me and also heartening in another way.
Yeah.
Like, if something like this, or when you saw Tree of Life, which I haven't seen.
Oh, it's great.
But to have that experience of... Oh, you know what movie I saw that I had that experience with?
Yeah,
was the only movie I've ever seen at TIFF was The Brown Bunny, the Vincent Gallo movie.
Right, yeah.
And I was so upset in the screening because it had already gotten, like, kind of panned.
Yeah, it came out of Cannes, and I think we had a different cut, too.
Maybe, but... Anyway, there was just this, like, smugness in the audience, but a smugness that comes from people who've already been told by somebody else what to think, and it was making me so angry because I actually really liked the film a lot. And you know what? Similarity is not narrative, weird, just emotional relationship stuff, but I was like, I am taken aback by a lot of what's going on here. And a road movie of sorts.
Yeah.
I really, really liked it and was just... Like, people were laughing in a sort of self-conscious way, being like, we know we're on the insider club, because somebody else already told us, if you don't like it, leave.
Yeah.
And let me just watch this movie, you pretentious pieces of shit.
I know,
like, that's how I felt.
I've had those moments. I think I was at the second press screening for that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And all I knew was that I liked Vincent Gallo's stuff. And I know he can be self-indulgent, but... And I'm not crazy about Buffalo 66. I think he gets at something, but
I like it.
I didn't love it. I liked it, but didn't love it. And then I saw this and it's like, oh, it's sad. I get it. Like, it's just really, really sad. It's a mournful movie about a lost man.
And he's self-indulgent, but also, like, shows you his self-indulgence quite honestly,
exactly.
Which is very unusual. Like, it's like, yeah, you're a bit of an odious creep, but you've put all that out there. Who does that?
Yeah, it's part and parcel of the narrative, even, or the aesthetic, because it's not really a narrative. But I experienced the same thing from members of the press who were there presumably because... It was this big deal that Roger Ebert had shat all over at Cannes like 6 months earlier or 4 months earlier, and everybody like were cramming into the theater to see it. And it's like, I kind of get this. I never go into a movie expecting to hate it, although, you know, Transformers 5, I'm not holding that much hope.
Yeah, sure.
But why would you do this if you're not going to enjoy it, if you don't hope you're going to enjoy yourself? And maybe The Brown Bunny isn't the movie that you enjoy exactly, but it's still something that I could appreciate. And I mean, I wrote a piece about it when it came out on video because that was the only chance I got to write about it. And people were like, that movie? Really? It's like, yeah, I saw it, so I can say
exactly that movie. It was our fun thing to say that we didn't like it and we don't know anything about it. How many people saw that movie in the theater?
Not as many as claim they did, I'm pretty sure.
I know. Anyway, I mean, I'm just being an anti-snob now, but I just didn't want my experience ruined by people who I was like, are you enjoying this movie? Are you enjoying hating it? Are you enjoying being in a room with other people showing them that you hate it? Yeah. Which has nothing to do with the movie being on in front of you.
No, it's performative. It's it is hate watching, even though now that's a legitimate thing, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. People talk about shows that they can't. It's become a term that people throw at stuff like, oh, I can't stand this, but I still watch it every week. It's like, yeah. We used to call it a guilty pleasure, but now you can't do that because it acknowledges you're enjoying yourself. So now it's hate watching. That's the new phrase.
That's horrifying.
It kind of is.
Why would you spend your time actively looking for things to hate? Yeah. There's so much to hate just naturally.
Yeah, it just finds you.
It just shows up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I shamed Kate off of Criminal Minds once, not once. She watched it because she's a knitter and she doesn't have to look at the screen. And I would be in the room while she was watching this, and she's watching it on television, and I'm working on something on the computer, or like across the room.
Yep.
And Patton Oswalt has a whole bit about this, but it's actually true. You can't have it on in the background because eventually you hear how horrible things are, and then you look up and you see this level of gore, and it's always misogynistic violence against women is always much worse in these shows. And the idea of this program that's just there to say, like, oh, this most horrific thing, and then we're going to show you what's left of her face. And I would just say, why are you watching this? It's so awful.
I have the same conversation with my husband because I do the same thing. I watch all those procedurals. Yeah. And he's like, what are you doing? How can you watch murder all day long? Mm. I don't know the answer.
It's soothing. I mean, the structure makes people happy.
Yeah, procedurals in general I find soothing.
Mm-hmm. No, that's common. I mean,
I don't know. Also, women seem to be quite into them, and I don't understand that either. Maybe we're stealing ourselves to some, like, fear that...
Is it the catharsis? Is it the idea of watching someone else?
I have no idea. I really don't, but it does tend to be women, in my experience, who are really into these shows. I don't know.
Yeah, it definitely is, which I find fascinating.
But I think, like, scaring yourself so you'll be more on edge, I don't know.
Yeah.
That doesn't... I don't feel more on edge.
It's not a form of prepping.
That's what I think, maybe. Yeah. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a stupid actor.
Oh, you're not stupid.
I'm a genius.
You're actor. Intuitive. That's different. It's an emotional intelligence, which comes back to Badlands, because that's the kind of movie where we are being confronted with awful things.
Mm-hmm.
And if not sympathizing, then at least understanding the people who are perpetrating them.
And how it can happen. You know that scene where he locks the kids up in like a tornado shelter thing?
Yeah.
And then just shoots through the top of it and then goes, do you think they're dead? I do remember these lines. Do you think they're dead? And she's like, I don't know. He's like, I'm not looking at them to find out. And they run away.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
It's horrible, but it's funny. I mean, it is like
that moment is weird
sort of gallows humor.
Yeah, the moment where he's like...
the person holding the gallows rope instead of being on them.
He's like, I don't want to see... Ooh, it could be gross?
Yeah.
Like, what's he saying?
The thing that you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's so much about Kit that's idealized and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin Sheen in 1973 is... like, he was just an amazing specimen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even as far... you go as far as Apocalypse Now, and he's... there's something about his eyes, his jaw. He's really fascinating. And he's a handsome man, but... visually, there's light hits him. You know, movie people aren't like us. They're different. Their bodies retain sunlight somehow, and they look better on camera. But he was just this beguiling figure. And if he's not, like, there's this whole thing that's going on with the way she idealizes him. Not idolizes, but idealizes him. So maybe, yeah, his heart is too pure to see the damage he's wrought or something. But it's all there. Like, you could read that into it if you wanted to.
Yeah.
I got to meet him a couple years ago when he came through with The Walk. I think it was called The Walk. Or The Way. It was The Way.
Uh-huh.
the one that Emilio had directed, his son. He was acting for his son, and it was a round table kind of situation. And because it was so close to Tree of Life, and Malick was suddenly active and making movies again, I just had to. I was like, I know you're not going to say anything, but can you say anything? It might have been 2013. It might have been the 40th anniversary of the film, of Badlands.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said it was a really. I didn't know how much I'd learned making that movie until years and years later. Terry and I still stay in touch. We talk about basketball.
Hmm.
And that's all I want, right? Yeah. That's how I want to imagine that process that led to Kit, specifically. I want him to stay unknowable.
Yeah.
I don't want to know what it is I find so fascinating about him, because I'm worried that the answer might be something really awful. You know, something either really simple or something too profound.
As an actor watching it, too, I felt like there was such a like bubble of safety around the actors, mm-hmm. and freedom in a way that it's the kind of space that creates good performances. I don't know, and I really don't need to know how Terrence Malick works. I'm just glad that it happens, because, you know, for me watching it, I just think you need to, whether someone else does or you do, you need to give yourself permission to have some freedom, which clearly both of them took,
mm-hmm.
you know, as actors. They're working with their director very much, but it's a director who really knows how to work with performers.
Yeah.
Because there's like a freedom, and you can see it. Sometimes they're very loose, like, as characters, they're very loose with each other, and sometimes they're very uncomfortable with each other. They're really uncomfortable in this scene where they're kissing, and I love that.
Oh, yeah.
It's very weird and wooden. And it's amazing, because it's like, oh, there's so much, again, communicated here in the fact that, like, they're kind of in this mythic love. But anything real is quite difficult for them. And sex seems to be, like, not that enjoyable. They're both like, what, it's not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, as with the kissing, I mean, it's something that they know they're supposed to do, right? It's performance.
Exactly.
In a weird way. And again, you know, the kids today don't understand small town teenagers in the 1950s had nothing but movie magazines and encyclopedias. There's no modeling that you can do with television or the internet or anything. Those people were on their own more than, you know, like big city folk.
And they are reading out of like a gossip magazine at one point, right?
That's
like
the only connection they have to a larger world.
Yeah.
And so maybe the crime spree is partially motivated by an attempt to be part of that larger world, you know, the romanticism of criminal life. But there's just, it's not that they don't know what they're doing, it's that they do know what they're doing. They're just not enjoying it in a lot of ways. In strange sort of antisocial or socially awkward. I don't even know how, I don't think there's a term for it. But they're...
Well, they could be psychotic.
Yeah,
it's possible. But I don't even want to accept that.
Yeah, it's too easy. It's too reductive.
I just wanted it to be that they, I think there are lines that sort of indicate this of like, I could just stay here, but why bother? You know? She didn't have to go with him, but she said something about like, you know, I could not go, but 2 weeks with someone I love, which is also like a grand statement, weird thing. But there's also just this like, look at the town, what your life's going to be like. She says Cheyenne is like the biggest, most wonderful city she's ever seen.
Right.
And she sees the lights of it from far away. It's like the isolation of these people. Does it matter if they kill other people or get shot? Are their lives worth anything? Have they been told their lives are worth anything?
Exactly.
Or anyone's lives are worth anything in this situation?
Yeah. If no one's going to amount to anything, what difference does it make if they stay or in the world or not?
Yeah.
And what difference does it make if you take them out?
Yeah.
It's this, I was going to say rat's nest, but it's not even that, because a rat's nest metaphor implies
activity.
Like, agitation, yeah. Yeah. And this is really just so strangely calm and contented, I think, is the word I would use. She's comfortable with her choices, even if she doesn't know how to express them. There's a confidence, and she knows what she's doing. When she's emulating, when she's replicating, she's doing it awkwardly.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know if this is to argue that she's seduced by Kit or that she's enthusiastically complicit. Like, mm-hmm. How hard does he have to try to get her to go with him?
Yeah, not very hard at all.
Yeah.
Or we don't see it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't see a lot of the things happen.
Yeah. It's missing all the pieces that...
tell you what's going on.
I was going to say that a Criminal Minds episode would fill in, right? Because they'd be these overheated, shaky cam, saturated shots of, hey, baby, I have a car, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and also stuff where, like, the people on the trail are, like, deconstructing everything and explaining again everything that's happened and might happen.
Yeah, exposition about the mental state, and the paint is fresh, this means this, that kind of thing. Which is, again, of course procedurals are successful because they give you the satisfaction of playing detective and also being part of that. And it's apparently quite easy to write because there are only five plots and they keep using them. But with Badlands, we're removed from so much of the expected material where there's so little discussion of motivation. There's so, like, if there's a grudge, it's no more complex than the Wild One, right? Like, what are you rebelling against? What have you got?
Yeah.
Kit just doesn't want to be there. It's not his world, and he's going to ruin as much of it as he can before he goes out.
He's bored. And he wants to be someone.
Yeah.
They both just want to, well, he more so, just wants to be a celebrity or be, even just have meaning. You know, and like at the end, just saying, I think I always wanted to be a criminal, I guess just because it's something.
Yeah.
Because what are you going to be otherwise? It's and like in those moments, I was like, it's just like the American dream. I want to distinguish myself.
Yeah.
Well, what are my options? I don't really have an education. I was a garbage man. I guess I'll go shoot people.
Right.
You know,
it's really
go and wild.
It's the kind of thing that, you know, it's not. Based on subsequent evidence, it's not wrong. That does work. Mm-hmm. Like, you can become famous by doing nothing but harm.
Mm-hmm.
And now, like 50 years later, there's this movement to not use the shooters' names in stories, which I think in news coverage, which I think is pretty great, although ultimately flawed. Because you can't... I mean, it'll take one disreputable asshole to run it as a free speech issue, and then it just ruins it every time.
We're in a really weird zone. I was about to have a very strange thought about, like, in order to make the sort of the capitalist society that we live in work, I think we need, like, religion to tell us to just toil away and be humble.
That was sort of the point of
Marx,
the opiate of the masses.
But it works. Now we don't have this, so, like, okay, great, Marx, it's gone. But now people still want to be individuals and have been given, are so disenfranchised. But this sort of stuff is actually happening all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, people go shoot up schools. Yeah. Some people think that, you know, aliens are in their heads and want to do it for that reason. But some people just don't even understand. They're just numb.
Yeah.
They just want to do something. It's so terrifying.
Yeah.
And that's, there are moments in this movie that I find really chilling in that respect. Just like the tension of, you have established that anything can happen in this film because there is no motivation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if there's no motivation, it's quite scary. And that's what's scary about, you know, like random violent crime on the street. When someone comes up to you and they don't ask you for money and they're being weird with you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's going on?
Yeah.
And that's, I think there are ways in which this movie does that, that kind of fear of like, he's just walking around. He has a gun. He could shoot it at any time or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's completely up to chance. There's no moral justification. There's nothing you could do to change what he's going to do.
Yeah. Or if there is, you can't know what it is.
Exactly.
There's no logic to it.
But the sense of a chaotic force. And I think that's what's so distinctive about Badlands as opposed to Malick's other work. His stuff gets progressively calmer and more contemplative.
Mm-hmm.
Badlands has a genuine terror inside of it, and you can't see it ever. You can never tell when it's going to come out. No one knows what triggers it. We spend the entire movie in this strange place watching with the accomplice as the bad thing that takes center stage.
Mm-hmm.
Kid is always in control, even when he doesn't know what to do, because he's the only one who's capable of doing anything.
Yeah, and he's always making a plan on the fly that seems to make no sense.
Yeah.
Like making a pile of rocks for a while.
Yeah,
and then going.
And maybe that just keeps him from killing someone. Like maybe that just keeps him busy or distracted. Maybe that's what he needs.
Yeah, And weirdly, yeah. like, I don't even, for most of the movie, he actually does kind of seem to make sense to me in a way.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, he doesn't seem psychotic. I guess he must be, but I don't know.
Yeah. But if we're seeing it through his eyes, then he's at the very least a romantic figure and,
yeah.
you know, at best heroic.
But also, like, I don't know. He just sort of makes sense and they're like, yeah, what have you been given? Shit.
Mm.
There seems to, doesn't seem like, we know nothing really of his past. We know nothing of his past, but he doesn't, it doesn't feel like he's been given any sort of hope or any plans from anyone else or any framework from anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just making his own on the fly and it's super weird.
Yeah.
But in a way, that's what everybody does, right?
Yeah.
They just don't choose to shoot people.
We're all, yeah, exactly. We're all pretending to be adults. We're just, some of us are doing a better job at reining in the impulses that are terrifying and awful and inside, presumably inside everybody. I mean, I've met people who I would say are genuinely, truly good people, but I bet they still lose their temper. It's just that here you have someone who's already given into it. And, you know, like he's strangely calm most of the time because he knows what he's capable of, or he's already done it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's terrifying because it means he could do it again, or he wants to, and he's barely stopping himself. There's so much going on in Sheen, but he keeps it all. It's that line from The Birdcage, right? You're doing this and this and this, but you keep it all inside.
Mm-hmm.
That's the weirdest. I don't think anyone will ever compare The Birdcage to Badlands again. Let's start with a B. Maybe that's it. But it's a great movie for that sort of behavioral study, because it just keeps not revealing. Like, you can stare at it all you want and it's not going to give you anything unless it seduces you and then you fall into it.
Oh, another thing I noticed this time, which I hadn't noticed before, which seems like so painfully obvious, is that, like, as the movie progresses, the landscape gets bigger and bigger and more open.
Mm-hmm.
The shots get further away from them and they become smaller.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you know, first of all, it's such a simple choice on Terrence Malick's part. And secondly, how could I have seen this movie so many times and never noticed that? Something so obvious and broad that's happening.
Don't feel bad.
And they just, yeah, but like, that's what's so beautiful about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Is that, like, you know, and that's the magic of what he does in his storytelling. Is like, this is such an obvious, overt choice. And there's so much else going on that it's not noticed because it, in a different director's hands, you'd go, oh, I see what you're doing. And
yeah.
It would be eye-rolly. There's so much that he does that could be eye-rolly that to me is not.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing where it's like, yeah. And then they're just like, it's just like them alone as specks on this giant plane. When in the beginning there were like scenes of them together.
Yeah.
And they're filling the whole screen. It's just like, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
It's so perfect.
But it's only, yeah, exactly. It's only obvious in retrospect because if you buy into it, if you're involved in the film, you won't notice because
mm-hmm.
you're just sharing the perspective.
Yeah.
At least, you know, crime stories, crime dramas exist to let people believe in an orderly universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that you can trust the authorities and everything works out and it's going to be fine in the end, but it always starts with a crime, generally with murder, because that's the only way to get people's attention.
Yeah.
And there isn't a happy ending for the dead person. And Badlands is one of those movies that just says, look, it's awful out there. It's not, you know, the juvie movies that it's sort of riffing on were always morally correct because the Hays Code demanded it. You had to have bad people punished. You couldn't get away at the end.
Yeah.
And Badlands just sort of leaves you with this drifting feeling that everything is not going to be okay.
And there's no talk of God.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting.
Especially for Malick, who's all of his films are about the search for something.
Which might be what this film is about, but there's no talk of it. Like, one of the things that the movie really made me think of was Flannery O'Connor. Although there's so much talk of God in Flannery O'Connor stuff, like in Wise Blood. And this movie has no talk of God, and then, like, but there is talk of death.
Yeah.
So what does that mean to them? Like, the lights are going to go out at some point?
Yeah. And
or they're going to go to hell? Or they're going to go to heaven?
Yeah. And in the era in which it takes place, religion was everywhere. It
mm-hmm.
wasn't, like, the American thing. It was a constant in people's lives.
Yeah, and in a small town.
Especially now. Yeah.
In, you know, you, if you didn't go to church, you'd be like ostracized in your small community.
Yeah.
And it's never brought up at all or mentioned.
Yeah.
And I don't even think I can remember like images, religious images in it, but maybe there were.
I don't remember any iconography. I was going to say that the way the images are constructed sort of feels like it's halfway to a devotional. Like the use of
what
nature.
What do you mean by a devotional?
The way that he lights, the way that he shoots the natural world, there seems to be something really bigger going on, something almost spiritual in the treatment of just being outdoors. I mean, he does that now all the time, and I think I'm backfilling it.
Yeah.
You know, there is inevitably in a Terrence Malick film somebody running their hand through some wheat or someone spinning outside.
Like dipping their toes in a river. That's in Badlands.
That's where it starts.
Splashing your toes around.
But that's it. Like, the communion is natural. It's not spiritual. It's just being alive, which, of course, because Kid kills people, it's that much more valuable. You know, like, I think we're watching the movie tell you that it's good to be alive, even when people are dying left and right, but not in a closer to God kind of way, just in an existence sort of way, an awareness.
You know what just occurs to me now is, okay, one of the other movies that I was considering, one of my other favorite movies, is Jesus of Montreal. And it's a story about Jesus and about religion and and whatever.
Well, the passion.
Yeah. And it's such an, it's a very obvious metaphor that's happening in that film. But one of the things that's really interesting is that there are scenes missing that you don't see. You don't see people kind of hook up and then you realize they're together just through inference. And there's some of that here too, in the things that you don't see happen. And it was pointed out to me at one point about Jesus of Montreal, that that's very much like the Bible. There's just stuff missing. You don't know how certain things happened. Oh, but now they have a kid.
Well, that's true. There's sort of like time jumps almost.
Yeah. And
just pick up the narrative later.
And you have to, well, and that's why we argue about, I mean, there's many reasons why we argue about the Bible, but you know, like, there's interpretation because we have to string the pieces together and they're not all put out for us. And, and it occurs to me now that this movie does that too. There's just important things missing.
Yeah.
And that some of the most important texts that we consider the most important as people are missing so much of the information we'd most like to have.
Yeah.
And it makes us go crazy, and that's why we do have wars. Okay, I guess Terrence Malick just made, like, the Bible in a movie.
In a weird way, he does that. It's, it's an elliptical approach to storytelling in that things just manifest fully formed, and you have to figure out what they mean and what they're doing there.
Yeah, like, missing the part where he convinces her to go with him is huge, right?
Yeah.
But that's one where it's, and it's really in a narrative sense, to me, it's really lovely to have that be left up to me. But in a sense of, say, like, the Bible, these are the things that make us go absolutely insane.
Yeah.
It's like, but how? We need to know. We need to know what he was thinking. What was Jesus thinking?
Yeah. Right? You talked a lot, but you didn't talk about this one thing.
That
so
we're really arguing about forever,
I'm going to say it means gays can't marry. Well, okay.
But yeah, so like, but also this Kit himself allows that mystery, maybe because it's interesting too.
Yeah, well, he doesn't, I mean, he doesn't reveal, like, he simply is.
Mm-hmm.
So he might have just wandered in.
But also he's also modeled himself, like, after James Dean, and that's constantly brought up. Or maybe it's brought up twice, but...
Well, it's there, but yeah.
But, you know, that's also, like, an inscrutable character with a big myth around him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know that Kit's also cultivating myth.
Right, but he's borrowing it, which makes it even scarier that there might not be anything else under it. Right? At least Dean built his own thing.
Yeah.
Kit just appropriated it.
Yeah. Or the thing under it is just wanting to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same. I don't know. I feel like we're going around in circles in a certain way.
Well,
is this interesting?
We're spinning. We're spinning like a Malick character.
Is it interesting?
I think it's interesting.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no, I think so. But I think ultimately that does bring us to the point, which is that it's an unknowable motivation. The movie's not unknowable. It's right there. And you can watch it. But, you know, you said it at the beginning, you can interpret it in a million different ways and not ever be wrong. Although I do think you're right. I think you have the take on it.
I think I'm right too, because I'm a woman and she's a woman, so I have to be.
The last question on the show is always the same, which is, like, what of Badlands has infected your creative DNA? What have you taken from it? Do you use it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I touched on it before, that the idea of having the confidence in mystery, I guess. That's been something that for me in comedy has been a huge point of interest, which is how much does the audience need to know? And the work that I'm doing right now is probably the worst example of that because it's political satire.
Right.
So political satire doesn't exist well in mystery and vagueness, right?
Sure.
But the other kind of comedic work that I like to do, I really like to experiment with how much information the audience requires.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that regard, a movie like Badlands is a huge inspiration. I mean, the list of movies that I would say inspired my comedy are generally not comedy films, like overtly, but a lot of David Lynch and movies like this that really allow a lot of interpretation. For like more laughs per minute comedy, you do need to give the audience more, but
right.
I'm really fascinated in how little you can say, because for me, one of the things that I really want to do is not just tell an audience what to think and feel, but hopefully do something that resonates in some way with what people in the audience have experienced in their own lives. And of course, that's a magic trick if you can do it, and it's a real ideal to shoot for, but the only way to do that is to leave some openness for the audience to fill in with their own experience. It's quite a hard thing to do, but movies like this have really inspired me in that direction. And it's something that in comedy, when you see it, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But a lot of comedians don't go there. And actually, bringing up Richard Ayoade is interesting because I think he's a performer who does some of that. He can do a very broad character where sometimes something else is going on.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Or in his direction, certainly. He's someone I find very inspiring. Christopher Morris, absolutely, who's another British comedian. But like,
yeah.
I mean, and he's gone extremely far in those experiments of like, how much should I let the audience in to the point of like complete alienation sometimes.
Yeah.
But still, seeing comedians work in that mode is amazing for me, and that's what I aspire to. Whether or not I can achieve it, I don't know.
Is there someone who's doing it? Is there somebody who's like doing that kind of work right now?
I'm trying to think. Well, an even greater thing that made me depressed in the end about this film was I was like, and you would know better because you see more movies than I do, but I was like, are movies like this still getting made? You know, we live in this time of franchises to the point that like even pitching a movie the first time around, it's like, what's the franchise potential of this film?
Yeah.
The way that things are being made, I don't know where is this weirdo work coming from?
Yeah.
I know it's out there, but if it's all short funny YouTube clips, which are great, how does that weird stuff happen?
Yeah,
it's probably happening in England. The funding system is different.
How do you encourage it into the world? How do you coax it and nurture it?
Well, and especially, why do you do that if maybe only 20% of the population might have any remote interest in it?
Yeah.
And this is capitalism, so that doesn't count.
I think that's where we're heading, though. I don't think there's ever going to be, like, you know, as much as everyone was talking about Stranger Things when it was on Netflix, its numbers weren't as high as Fuller House. I think we're going to get to a point where people realize that 20% of the world is okay. Like, that's a good number to shoot for.
Now that we can access the whole world, 20% is okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're finally at a place where niche programming... I mean, the nerds are winning now. There's a new Star Trek series. There's Stranger Things has a second season coming. Marvel is the dominant force of narrative on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily encouraging in terms of where narrative is going, but there's places in the niches, there's worlds that you can explore that might be worth chasing.
But does Slow and Arty have a niche that will pay money?
I think so.
I
hope so. Yeah, I mean, certainly I'm out of a job if it doesn't. But it's a thing that I think we're getting there. Like Jeff Nichols, who made Midnight Special.
There's a good example.
And Loving. He's the guy I was thinking of when you were asking that question. He told me, I mean, specifically when he made Midnight Special. Have you seen Midnight Special?
I have. Did you know that Michael Shannon came and played the improv set with us?
No.
Yes.
Oh, my God. When? How?
Like,
oh,
a couple
Jesus.
Weeks ago.
God.
It was great.
He is...
He is
I've
amazing.
Seen him. I've seen him on stage, but I've seen him play.
He was very, very nervous.
Oh.
And quite lovely. Anyway.
Yeah, the more I see of him, the more... I've interviewed him a couple of times, but the more I see of his work in the world, like just how he wanders around and does stuff, the more appreciation I have for him.
I love the movie Mud. Actually, and there's a lot of similarities between Badlands and Mud.
Yeah.
Because it's like like even just like making a weird tree camp out in the woods.
Yeah. The like, ambiguous male lead. And
yeah. I thought about that. I thought about Mudd a lot, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jeff Nichols is a good example. Although I would say people are doing this work, but I was thinking more like who's doing comedy like this?
Oh, comedy. Yeah.
Jenny Slate does some stuff that works in that world. Her weird Catherine show, this like web series she did, was definitely weird and strange and comedic. Yeah, I'd put that in that category.
Okay, I haven't seen that. I'll have to look it up. I mean, I know her work, but I'm not aware of the web show.
I forget the channel. It's on a YouTube channel.
I'll find it.
Catherine is what it's called.
Cool.
But that's fun where it's like you're working with weirdness, but you're very much like, this is comedy and I know what I'm doing.
Right. There are shows that are coming out like that now. I think now that also that the tools of production are cheap enough that you could do something for very little money.
Mm-hmm.
People are sort of embracing that possibility and there's stuff out there where, I mean, and I got it with Dan Harmon's Community, which is a, you know, multi-million dollar sitcom, but mm-hmm. it felt like it was made exclusively for me. Like, this is my thing.
Rick and Morty deals with some very bizarre stuff.
Oh, wow.
Where it goes full funny, and then also it's like, and you're dealing with people, like, in personal collapse in a show that's very much written to be punchy as well.
Yeah.
So that's an unusual... There's another example.
Yeah, we talked... Harmon and I did the conversation with him for JFL, and he talked about it briefly, and I was like, well, the Come Watch TV is you, right? Like, Roiland is doing all this bizarre alien stuff, and over here in the corner, you're working on this amazing existential arc where, you know, I eat breakfast 30 feet from my own body. That speech is just incredible and devastating. He said, yeah, we did it in, like, the sixth episode, because fuck it, we're just going to go in.
Yeah.
And he's... Right. Like, you have to do it now. You have to... I think the point he was making was there's no point in playing something safe. If you have a concept, you should burn through the story and force yourself through it and see what comes next.
Yeah.
But that is a high wire act that doesn't work for everybody because it becomes the gesture that attracts people rather than the work.
Right.
It's like, look what I did. It's like, yeah, but that guy did it and made me cry.
Yeah.
The next step is what's more interesting. And what Nichols is doing, what he does with Midnight Special, though, is mm-hmm. he said that what he was doing was, how much do people need? How much information can I withhold? Do I even need to talk about the nature of this thing or where they were or what the cult believes? And he said he realized if you just show it, if you pick up the story where it starts, which is the road part, and the cues, like the 80s stuff he uses, the visual quotes and the musical score... Yeah. That will guide people in. And if they know what I'm doing, they'll get it. And if they don't, hopefully they'll get it 20 minutes later.
And in Midnight Special, at the end, I saw more than I had to. I actually didn't to have seen so much.
That last glimpse?
Yeah, I was like, I actually didn't need this much. For me, personally, obviously, everything's like subjective.
A couple of other people said the same thing. And it's like, I thought about... Because we talked about... potential spoilers for Midnight Special, listeners. We talked about Starman. At the end, the John Carpenter film with Jeff Bridges.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you remember at the very end of Starman, is the whole thing is represented by some snow and red light. There's nothing, like, you don't
see... I don't remember the end, but...
You don't see beyond that. You see the alien returns home, spoiler, and it's depicted... And now, all of a sudden, my head is just making connections between Starman and Badlands, and they're not wrong.
Hmm.
It's a road movie. It's about two people on the run. It's about people who don't understand the world around them, but...
Well, we have to watch Starman again.
Yeah, you totally should. But it's... That was one of the models he used for Midnight Special, because what can you get away with, and how much do you need to see? And, yeah... Now there's a straight line between Midnight Special and Badlands with Starman in the middle, and I find that weirdly comforting.
This is probably a quote from someone that I don't know who said, but it's that idea that when you write a poem, that really you're only writing half. You know this?
Yeah, I've heard.
So
the,
the
sentiment expressed.
I'm sure I'm like not crediting this to the right person because I don't know who said it, but yeah, when you write a poem, you only write half, and the reader writes the other half. But that's that same sense of mystery, and I feel like I really worry that we're losing that in the general society that we're in. And not everybody has to like poetry or whatever, but I think it's extremely ungenerous to an audience to do everything for them. I think it leaves nothing. For them.
Mm-hmm.
And this, Badlands, is a film that gives me so much and gives me so much space of my own to fill in. And I get to make it my own story, and it's so completely its own story as well.
Poetry.
Poetry.
My thanks to Becky Johnson, who is doing great weird things in the Second City's current review, Come What Mayhem. If you're in Toronto, go catch the show before the year is out. Thanks also to Damian Nelson. She knows what she did. You can find Becky on Twitter at JohnsonBecky, all one word, and you can find Badlands on Blu-ray and DVD in the Criterion Collection in a typically excellent special edition that includes a terrific retrospective documentary. It's also available for sale and rental on iTunes and Google Play, but come on, Criterion Blu-ray, guys, you know the deal. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. This week's call sign is, I can't deny we've had fun, though. Thanks for listening.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.